I would like to take a second to just thank some of the people who make this event possible every year. This great theater we're in, MTYP, is one of the most amazing theater spaces with great tech support. Let's just take a second to thank them. Even if he was a bit slow on the mic, tomorrow night is going to be faster on the mic. I winked at him. That made it all right, right? I'd also like to point out the gorgeous furniture provided again this year by EQ3. Yeah. And, you know, I thought I would look over here and point out the beautiful writers arrayed on this beautiful furniture, but they did not follow me. And should I go back out there and fetch them? Writers, come. Come in. There we go. All three of you. Come on. They're very shy. Can you give them a little clap? You see, I confused them with too many instructions in the green room. I threatened them with having to wear their name tags, and they got all nervous, and then they didn't know. They couldn't follow the rest of the instructions because it was so hard. When I said, I go in, you follow me, take a seat, I was like, oh, follow, I don't know, follow. writers don't follow. I don't know how many of you are writers or know writers well, but that was a little truth for you. I'd like to also recognize the other presence, ongoing presence on our stage here and in our festival, and that's McNally Robinson Booksellers. I honestly cannot imagine the city without McNally, and I can't imagine this festival running this way without McNally. And I'm happy to say that they are the evening's sponsor, so we're happy to be able to recognize them that way as well. Before we dig into the great fun of hearing a bunch of new voices and others that are maybe not new to you, I would just take a second to remind you to please turn off your cell phones, because I will actually walk out into the audience and confiscate them if they ring. I've always wanted to do that. And also, if you're a person who's thinking that maybe you'll... Oh, there goes one. Good. Any others? Yeah, the takers. If you're also a person who's about to have a coughing fit in the middle and you have those little, like the real crinkly wrappers on your candies, or if you're just like a hard candy addict, maybe you could unwrap those now so we can get that out of the way too. It's very distracting, you know, for your neighbors. Okay, that's the last of the, you know, lecture mode. Now that I'm a director, I get to be much more bossy. I'm liking that. It's really great. I was realizing today in one of my little tiny radio hits that I am not well-suited for radio, because I actually don't know how to do, like, a one-minute bite. I'm like a 10-minute bite. And the radio, you can see these radio hosts kind of getting that slightly panicked look. Oh, you know, where do I cut her off? Because not only do I do large bites, but they're kind of speedy and not a lot of breaks in the middle. And as I was thinking about this as I was driving back to the hotel and thinking, you know, I think that... that I'm not a one-minute bite person, because I'm actually really interested in the complexity of things and not the simple picture of things. And I tell you that story because, in a way, I think that's what's very special about tonight's writers in this show that I'm calling On the Edge. All of these writers are exploring the complexity of situations and of character responses on the edge of all sorts of things, on the edge of madness, on the edge of insight, on the edge of memory, on the edge of transformation. And they patiently unpack so much of the texture around those moments of anxiety and exhilaration that are those moments of being on the edge. I'm really delighted to introduce to you this evening's readers, and we'll start with Sadura Ludwig, who comes back to Winnipeg, having made the rash decision to move to Toronto. I knew her when she was a young thing of about 13 or 14, and already then she knew she was going to be a writer, and so did I. I met her in a writing workshop and could see that she had all sorts of things that it takes to be a writer. And when her first novel, Holding My Breath, came across my desk, I was absolutely thrilled to see it and to know that I could invite her back. So please, let's give a Winnipeg welcome back to Sadura Ludwig.
Hi. Hi, thank you very much for welcoming me back. When I was a teenager and aspiring writer in this city, and I keep telling this story throughout the week, but I'll just do it one more time. And this festival was a one-day festival over a weekend. I used to volunteer at it, and I used to sit and watch the writers coming in and sort of go, oh, wow, I wish that could be me. So it's particularly thrilling for me to be here and to be a part of the festival. My book, Holding My Breath, is about a young woman growing up in the north end of Winnipeg in the 1950s and 60s, and it's about her relationship with her mother and her aunts and how she finds herself through their stories and through her own. The novel takes place over about 20 years, and the section that I want to read to you from is when the main character, Beth, is around 11 years old, and they have just moved into a larger home and a little more, and their family has just sort of moved up the ranks a bit, and her mother has joined something called the Monday Group, which is a group of women that would meet once a week and study texts and discuss things that's what I thought I would set the stage for you so that you understand where we're coming at. Sometime before the weather turned cold, I started crawling out of my window at night and sitting on the wide, flat ledge of the roof beneath my windowsill. I watched the stars and learned their patterns, drawing my own sketches with a marker and flashlight. I could find Andromeda and Cassiopeia, the teapot and the Milky Way. All of our world's finest stories were illustrated up in the sky. Sometimes I made up my own constellations. I even named one Romeo and the other Juliet, and I found they were reaching for each other. I wrote an essay for my English class about the mythology of the night sky, for which I got an A. When I brought it home, my mother's face lit up right through her eyes. She positively sparkled. Beth, this is wonderful! And then the words I hadn't realized I longed to hear. I am so proud of you. She didn't actually read the essay. It was the mark that counted. She took the report and went immediately to call the women in the Monday group, even before she called my father at the pharmacy. She called each and every one of them almost breathless. Just listen to what Beth's teacher said on her report, I heard her say over and over again. A very mature look at a complicated, impressive subject. Your writing is well beyond your years. Well beyond her years. She's so modest, we had no idea how talented she is. That night, after all the phone calls, including one to Auntie Carrie, who asked to speak to me and then said, you keep up this good work, Bethy. Nothing is more important than your education. My mother came into my bedroom and told me I had been invited to come and read at the next Monday group meeting. At 11 years old, I was the youngest daughter ever to be asked to attend. We're going to look at Romeo and Juliet, but we want you to read Juliet's soliloquy, O Romeo, Romeo, my mother told me. She gave me a copy of the play so that I could practice before going to sleep. I got into my pajamas and Mum sat with me and put my hair into two French braids. All the women were so impressed with your English mark, she continued, as she brushed my hair and pulled it back tight. The next morning, I would have waves almost like a perm. Normally, we wouldn't invite a daughter until she was much older, but the ladies really feel you're ready. She finished the braids and knotted the bottoms into two elastics. When she let go, I felt them fall against my back. This is a big honor, you understand, she said. I nodded. I could feel the braids against my shoulder blades. I am very proud of you, she told me, leaving the play in my hands. I didn't read it that night, but I did sleep with it against my chest. I dreamt of being tied up by my braids and someone tearing up my mother's book in front of me. Every time I reached for it, the person jumped back laughing. I woke up clutching the book, bending the front cover. Plays are not meant to be studied. They're meant to be seen, Sarah said when I told her about my dream. By then, my Auntie Sarah was a university student, and she was studying psychology and theater. We were sitting in her room, which was across from mine, and she was reading her behavioral psychology textbook while I practiced my soliloquy. She pushed the book away from her and fell back against the pillows she had propped up against the wall. Those are the stuffiest, most know-it-all women I have ever met, she said. If you really want to understand Shakespeare, then you have to act it, she told me. You can't just read it in some North End Jewish accent and expect it to come alive. Mum says her books are like mini worlds, I said. I heard my mother say that to the women once, and they all agreed. Sarah took her book back. Yes, well, your mother needs her own mini worlds. For my inaugural meeting, my mother made spinach cheese pie, tuna salad sandwich rolls with relish, marinated bean salad on iceberg lettuce, and a pineapple upside-down cake for dessert. When it was a woman's turn to host the meeting, she had to provide lunch. Some of the women got help with their party sandwiches and cheese kugels, but my mother insisted on doing it all herself. I practiced my soliloquy in the kitchen the night before the meeting, and my voice seemed to echo out of the oven and the sink and all the cupboards. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. I attacked the words at exclamation marks, but said rose and sweet in breathy whispers to make them sound soft. The whole time I performed, I was Juliet. I imagined I had long golden hair and a nightgown that floated around me like angel's wings. I leaned on the kitchen table, as she would have on her balcony. Remember not to exaggerate, Mum said when I was finished. The women appreciate subtlety. She dried her hands and then held my cheeks. Her palm was cool. They will be very impressed with you. I pictured them, their makeup painting impressed on their faces, their lips shaped like red lifesavers, and their eyes not blinking but framed by long mascara lashes. And of course, I pictured my mother like a cartoon character, her heart beating out of her chest in neon colors, blinking the word pride. Sarah laughed at me as I performed my soliloquy for her. It wasn't a cruel laugh. She said I actually read it very well. So well, she would tell her friends at the drama society she was a part of, and if they were doing a play with a role for a child, maybe they would use me. She laughed because she said this reading was like an initiation. Don't you get it, Beth? I was in my pajamas holding my reader at my side. Sarah was dressed up to go on a date with someone my mother did not approve of because he was not Jewish and he was from Dauphin. They're making you become one of them, you and all their daughters. You guys are going to have to pledge to continue the Monday group for eternity, you know, or you'll be written out of their wills or something horrid like that, she said. Later, I would hear her arguing with my mother as her boyfriend honked for her from his car. Don't you care about your life, my mother would say to her. This is my life, and I love it. He's going to rip your heart out and eat it, Sarah, and he's not going to care if you lie there bleeding while he does. It's going to feel fabulous, Sarah responded, and I would take having my heart broken over making tuna fish sandwiches for my lady friends any day. I heard the front door slam, a car door open and close, and music blasting as they drove off. Then I heard my mother sink into the couch, crying as if it was her heart Sarah had torn out and thrown onto the floor. Inevitably, Sarah came home, maybe late at night, maybe early in the morning. She would throw herself onto her bed and sob into her pillow. She woke me up when she did this. She sounded like a puppy torn away from its mother. Once I went across the hall into her room and sat on her bed, reached out to touch her hair, and then took my hand back. Sarah brushed me away and said, "Don't look at me, Beth. Just leave me alone." I climbed off her bed and went into the hallway where I sat outside her room and listened to her cry until she had fallen asleep. In the morning, my mother found me on the floor in the hall, and she woke me by patting my face. Your aunt doesn't need you looking after her, she told me. She's making her own choices, and you don't need to be any part of it. And then, as if nothing had happened, Sarah would emerge from her room, her hair brushed so it shone, her lips freshly painted. She would eat an orange, peeling it with her fingers and wiping the juice from her chin. She would say nothing except, "I'm going out with some friends after class today, so don't expect me home for supper." And while I wanted to hold her back and never let her go, my mother would just nod, not looking at her. Only after Sarah left the house would my mother turn around, shaking her head, saying, "Stupid girl, that stupid, naive girl." The morning of the meeting, I watched my mother do her face. She sat in front of her three-way mirror. She wore green eyeshadow, coated her lashes, and used a lip pencil to outline her mouth before applying her lipstick. I really wanted to dress up that day like a proper actress. I remembered Sarah had a fuchsia feather boa in her closet from some performance. My mother never let me see her, nor would she let me go because Sarah wore fishnet stockings. "You're too young," Mum told me when I asked if I could dress up. "But you said I was old enough to read. You'll be a much better reader if you don't look ridiculous." I walked out of her room and into Sarah's. Sarah had already left for class. I took out her lipstick and smelled it. It smelled like crayon. And I thought of the way she would laugh with a bright red mouth, the one my mother told her was too bold. I outlined my lips with the thick paint and watched them bloom. Then I draped the boa around my neck and shoulders and let the feathers caress my cheeks. Downstairs, the women began to come through the door. It was winter, and each time the door opened, I could hear them coming up the walk slowly, the packed snow squeaking beneath their weight like old floorboards. I waited until all the women were in, Millie, Lil, Tess, and Myrna, before I descended the stairs. My mum greeted each by singing, "Hello, welcome." "It's so bitter out," they said. "Oh, you poor dears," my mother said, "coming all this way in the cold." My mother took their coats and hung them in the closet. The women removed their boots and slipped on their shoes, which they had brought in cloth drawstring bags. My mother's back was to me as I came down the stairs. "Beth, sweetheart," Lil said, which made all the other women look up, "don't you look grown up?" The women smiled. Each held back a quick laugh and a sigh that spread into a smile. I stayed halfway up the stairs like a movie star in perfect view of all her fans. My mother turned around and she stared at me. All I saw were those lines carved into her face. "Beth, dear, you'll come with me." I could almost feel the stairs crumbling beneath me. I hadn't understood that the invitation had actually been a test, that I had just failed. My mother came up the stairs and I followed behind her as she passed me. She walked straight into the bathroom and ran the water in the sink. I could see the steam rising from the basin. My mother was talking into the mirror while I stood in the doorway. "This is a privilege that our daughters only receive when we feel they are ready," she said. "Being grown up is about knowing your limitations." I let the boa fall to the floor while she lathered up a washcloth with soap. A young woman does not push her luck, only children do. I stood in the doorway and tried to swallow the tears and the lump quickly forming at the back of my throat. My mother's disappointment was as close as she would come to not loving me. She motioned for me to come to the sink, and when I stood close enough to her, she took my chin in her hand. The soap seeped through my closed mouth and tasted sour and sharp. I couldn't help crying while she scrubbed all the color away. I could see its stains on the cloth once she was done. When I looked in the mirror, I could see red blotches by my mouth where it had once been an elegant pink. My mother handed me a towel and watched as I dried myself. "My ladies are waiting for us," she said. "Do you think you're ready to join us properly now?" There was nothing I could do but nod. It was the first time I realized I was being bred for a life that nobody ever asked me if I wanted. It was the first time I wished I could disappear. My mother still wanted me to read, but I knew I was going to choke through the words. All I could imagine were the Monday women eating their cake in their crisp winter suits, waiting for a proper Juliet who would never appear. My mother put her hand over my head and then down along my cheek. It felt cool and soft against my hot face. I imagined it making an imprint on my cheek, knowing she would soon take it away. "Bethy," she whispered, "just come downstairs and be yourself." She let me cry a bit against her chest. She wore a pearl necklace and it left a chain of indents on my forehead. I left wet marks on her blue dress with the V neckline. When I was ready, we went down together where the women were smiling, colorful, waiting. They had helped themselves to coffee. The steam from their cups rose in thin, dancing lines like dangling threads. My mother led me down, her hand on my shoulder, me clutching my book in my damp palms. Thank you.
That's Sadura Ludwig. Just makes you want to dig out Romeo and Juliet, doesn't it? Or else maybe dig out that pink feather boa. Maybe I'll wear that tomorrow night. Mom, think it's a good idea? The next writer that I'm going to introduce to you tonight is Jill Adamson, who comes to us from Toronto as well. I first encountered Jill as a poet. I mean, her as a poet, a lot of years ago when I was doing graduate work and I was doing some reviewing and came upon this book, and it just opened me up in ways that I hadn't anticipated. And since then, I've tracked down her short fiction, and I was very delighted that this year she has produced her first novel, The Outlander. Please welcome Jill Adamson. Please welcome Jill Adamson.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlene. And thank you to everybody at Thin Air for having me here. It's the second time I've been here, and it's lovely to come. And thank you all for being here. It's hard with a novel to sort of pick a short thing that'll make sense to everybody. This may not make a lot of sense to you. Just let it roll over you. The book is set in 1903. The main character is Mary Bolton, who's known through most of the book as the widow, and she's a widow because she has shot and killed her husband, and she's now being pursued by her very angry brothers-in-law. The widow has somehow managed to flee right through and over the Kicking Horse Pass, and she's on the other side of it at this point, where she's been picked up by a man named Henry, who is Crow, or Absaroke, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Henry doesn't really care for the widow too much. There's something about her that kind of unnerves him, but he's taking her anyway to the nearest white town. It's a mining town named Frank, where he will dump her in the care of the local reverend. That's his intention. And in this scene, the widow is suffering from a leg wound, and they're on their way to Frank. Finally, all light fled. Henry halted, and they no longer heard the hooves beneath them on the scree shoreline. The horse's breath sounded hollow and small in the night. The widow felt Henry's hands about her waist, pulling, and she slid to the ground. With only one good leg, she sat heavily and yelped with pain, and she remained sitting, blind, as he took the horses away. Small dots of cold hit her cheeks, motes of snow falling from the empty heights. He was removing the tack. She heard the whop of leather cinches being undone, stirrups clacking against river stones at a little distance. The horses shaking like dogs, blowing, glad to get the saddles off. The sound of him currying the animals down with the blankets, then flapping the blankets out, one by one, near her. "Yours," he said, stamping his foot. "The nearest one." She rolled over onto it, her arms across her chest, and slept on rocks. Slept despite the howling of her wound. In the middle of the night, she dragged the blanket around her and cocooned, her face covered, her breath like a furnace. "Wake up," his voice came in the dark, a thin edge of a question in it. In her dream, he thought she was dead, that she'd died during the night, a body wrapped in its shroud, ready for the river, while inside a sly, dreaming ghost awaits. Her mind drifted off again. Then a boot nudging her, "Up now." They had bannock and coffee in the pre-dawn. Two figures crouched round the fire. Then they saddled up, the widow doing her slow part. They mounted and went on uphill, moving laterally along the higher range, the mare's shod hooves sparking as she slipped and scrabbled on the loose stones. Overhead, the morning sky glowed, cut sharp by the inky edge of mountain ranges all around them like a bowl, and everything in it was black and they were invisible. The widow gazed at the rock faces and tried to recognize something, anything, the pass she had traversed, or even a familiar peak, but all was strange and black. As the light grew, the air warmed quickly, and this brought forth from the trees a thin mist that ran in tributaries along the pebbled ground like a gray river. The horse's forelegs waded through it. By noon, it was raining, and they were going straight up. Henry sometimes on foot, leading the horses by the reins on the switchbacks, then mounting again and continuing uphill, both riders leaning forward in their saddles. The rain was fine and light, hardly falling, blowing on the wind. It blew under Henry's hat, and his face streamed and shone. They reached the town of Frank in the afternoon and went down the empty main street, followed by amiable dogs. It was hardly a town at all, just a federation of camps separated by mounds and fissures in the ground and by messes of cut lumber stacked high and stained nearly black by the weather. Buildings stood next to tents that stood next to hybrids of the two, unlighted and unpainted, made of hand-hewn boards, some caulked with mud or moss, or their listing walls were corduroyed and tufted. Few or none had windows. Outside one tent, a pair of coveralls had been hung out to dry, pointless in the drizzle, and a deep red mud dripped from its cuffs. "This is a town?" the widow asked, incredulous. "Where are all the people?" "People?" Henry craned round in his saddle. "The men are underground, in the mine." They came upon a strange low doorway cut in the side of the mountain, an air shaft no taller than a playhouse door. The widow looked uphill and saw two others, cut discreetly into white rock, framed carefully in thick black wood and standing no taller than 4 feet, as if some dandified gnome might soon step from his front door and greet the day. There were three shaft entrances in sight, but all were empty, and there were no sign of men. There was no sign of men anywhere. Just then the horses crested the seam of a rock like a great deep root of the mountain, and the travelers saw in the distance the gray and looming mine head, at the dark mouth of which human figures moved, stooped and hurrying. It seemed to the widow that they had moved from wilderness to wasteland. The mine head looked almost like a grain elevator, a tall, box-like structure with smaller boxes attached. The widow gazed about her in horror. Barrenness and ruin lay all about it, the building forming an epicenter of destruction. The ground was trampled and muddied and streaming, hatched with cart tracks, strewn with debris. Mounds of gray culm lay here and there, the chaff of coal mining, silvery rubble tipped out by the carts, through which ran negligible seams and chips of coal. Several of these knolls were smoldering, the coal on a slow burn, thin rills of smoke corkscrewing into the rain, the smell of it on the air, and pine and rain and mud. The horses stepped carefully over a narrow gauge track for mine carts that ran from the head, going downhill into the trees to some unseen destination. But this vast ugliness seemed to flash and be gone, like a contained blight, a comet's small impact. Then they were riding among the trees again, and even the dogs were silent, as if it had affected them too, and made them thoughtful about the ravages of man. If not for the simple footpath along which they rode, the widow might have thought herself miles from any town again. When they found him, the Reverend Mr. Angus Lorne Bonnycastle was standing on the roof of the skeletal frame of the church he was building, a pencil drawing of a stick cathedral with a dark little man on it. He had been working alone, down on one knee, hammering away, but he stood when he heard the horse's hooves. Seeing Henry, he waved eagerly, dropped his hammer, lost his footing, and fell on his back, nearly toppling from the apex. The widow let out a little yelp, and Henry put his hand to his mouth in unguarded dread. Eventually, the figure in black regained its balance, clambered up again, and waved. Through his fingers, Henry said, "Jesus Christ." In this next scene, we see William Moreland, who's I call the Ridge Runner, who is a hermit. He is also kind of unknown to him, in love with the main character, Mary, the widow. And at the moment, the hermit in him is winning out. The Ridge Runner went on, shouldering his rucksack high, yearning into the wilderness. A deserter amid the green, near blind with confusion, not having slept yet, for every breath in the trees seemed to promise her arrival. The movement of sunlight, a crack in the underbrush woke him, and he sat up round-eyed, a sorry grin on his face, a lie forming in his mouth. And then nothing. She did not come. How could she? So he rose and went on, looking back as a thief does. He had stolen something, and he knew it. And now, as shadows skated long over the ground, he stopped dead in his tracks and held his breath. An irregular thing lay on the ground a few paces back. Here was a fingerless hand, a mummified shoulder. He had stumbled across a fellow traveler. The shape of the fallen man expressed clearly on the ground, upholstered with grass. And 5 feet away, the upturned, jawless cranium with its little amphitheater of teeth. The Ridge Runner stood motionless, his eyes mere slits, a hand to his face as if there might still be a lingering stench. But there was none, and his leathery companion was as indigenous now as any fallen tree. It was a cruel joke, not on this other man, for that was obvious enough, but on Moreland himself. Even here, solitude was impossible, as if the world were a nerve-jangling carnival, where grotesqueries might swing out on springs and cackle at him. Lost and wild girls beckoning, dead men aping his own likely future. He stepped wide around the shallow lump, wide and quiet, and went on quietly, as if some unseen spirit hung in the trees watching. Then he started toward higher ground, moving not north or west, but up, higher, toward the peaks, away from man and woman, away from life itself. Thank you.
That's Jill Adamson. Some very wonderful, magical, difficult, perplexing characters in that novel. The third writer for the first half is a person that I should have encountered before. I think maybe I was on the edge, or maybe he was, because I think we inhabited the same place for a few years. He's the editor of the Wilfrid Laurier University Press, but I know him better as a poet. And his brand new book, Nerve Language, will rearrange your mind, I think. It certainly is a kind of catalog of a rearranged mind. Please welcome Brian Henderson. Please welcome Brian Henderson.
Thank you, Charlene. Perhaps, dear reader, or in this case, dear listeners, you will be familiar with the memoirs of my nervous illness, with appendices and an addendum about the question, under what circumstances can a person considered insane be detained in an asylum against his will? Published in the year after my freedom, 1903, which began a decade of scribbling throughout the century, from the likes of Freud, Jung, Bleuler, to Canetti, Niederland, Lacan, Deleuze, Anthony Wilden, and many others less famous. Beginning with Freud in 1911, who had been busy suppressing longings for his colleague Fliess in the wake of the dissolution of that friendship. In fact, almost at the exact moment Freud and Fliess were discussing the unconscious for the first time, I was deprived of my freedom in Dresden, halfway between Fliess's Berlin and Freud's Vienna. That would have been 1895. Now surely these Denkwürdigkeiten are enough for everyone, at least for everyone to use as evidence. Even too much, overwrought with systematizing, overwritten with an eye to impossible proof, and appended documents, medical reports, hospital charts in the new translations. It does not give way on principle, but I must now confess it is not all I wrote during that terrible time. And what your eyes now witness is something quite different, something I had hidden away from the guards and the doctors and the others. Although many keys carried across to the other side, such as you will find in Voluptuousness is a State of Mind, naturally occur in both, writing the memoirs would enable my freedom. The writing of these, the release of something else. Against the crenellating, the constant rustling of the voices, against the forensic languages and official pronouncements, the forking lightning of the nerve language, and how a human being in many places at once might learn to listen. Nerve language is Daniel Paul Schreiber's term for what God used to dismantle the cosmos and recreate it again. It's also the language that God spoke to Schreiber in The Lucky Man. And as a sort of divine language, it's filled with impossibilities. It's filled with silences, what you might imagine God would speak to you like. What would that be? Outside, It is outside the possible. And I have an outside poem here. Whenever the outside flares at the limit, whenever the leaves of its trees glint and blind, whenever the locusts of the outside go underground and take with them their shattering colors and mandibles, whenever the loss of words wakens you, lying along its border, stretched out like a knife at the foot of the wall, the knife that scratches away at the mortar around a few stones, whenever you must ask what the outside is, with its brutal and free music, and what is it that conducts the outside to you like shards of mica? Whenever you think it is the place you have lived, whenever angels, fiery beings, a woman's fingers on your brow, the impossible bliss of what looks into you reveals itself by withdrawing, tearing the muscle off your bones. Whenever you remember what has not yet happened, even for a second, the shimmered world pierced through reflection, light on the river, beyond the wall, just visible from a window, beckons, where the dead children escape their status and their names, and you've gone inside out. One of the ways that this nerve language manifested itself to Daniel Paul Schreiber was as rays of light. Rippled and dazzled in the waking light, wind frisking each needle of the pine forest, the room's objects that were once here think they are drowned for a moment before recollecting and composing themselves somewhere else. Of course, they are being molested by glances. They've all been removed against their will. Don't look, but surround yourself with looking. And so they want to take everything from me. My shoes, my wife, my sanity, my position, and so my dreams, writing instruments, shirts and cufflinks, my chess pieces, books, toiletries, handkerchiefs, and so the reputation of my father, and so called mad. I am otherwise entirely. Called paranoid, rather the apotheosis of those vanished things which made up who I was. My stillborn children, the crushing bundles of spears of light. I am what's left over. Hunger of dispersal. Schreiber was confined in an asylum for over 7 years. And for 2.5 years of those seven, he was further confined to solitary every night. Sink, one tap, one bench with bedding, one toilet, single high horizontal pipe, one grate, one standing for 2.5 years, every night in the questioning place, fingers like spiders skittering up the blind fabriced wall. As if underground, paralyzed, draped, one stone floor. One would hear whispering and whimpering, but the voices wouldn't hear completion. squirmed with their tipped poison. One is only the outline of their attack. Shadow room. No one's room. One. No. Rays pierce an eye, creating an iris for themselves and a looking. Schreber believed that cosmic forces were trying to track every movement and moment of his life. And he called this the writing down system. Not only were these forces trying to track him, but they were recording everything. It's the ultimate writer. So this poem is called The Writing Down System. It occurs to me that I myself am the writing down system that wants to capture everything, even the space between breaths, the coffee stains on the white shirt cuff, the diagonal sigh of the bishop across the board, the careless shrug of the shoulders, the lingerie drawer half open or three quarters closed, the orange rind on the windowsill, the scent of orange, the fingerprint in the dust, the glance that finds exactly what it's looking for. But there is nothing here now but pen and paper and darkness they do not let me out of. I cannot move, not even into the periphery of dream. The darkness is lucid with folds of satin. I cannot reply. Freedom sustains itself on limitation here. The endless limitation of words I am writing on the other side of writing. So one of the key notions for Schreber, since he was preoccupied with writing and since the memoirs that he wrote in the 1890s were sort of the basis of his attempt at freedom, was the whole notion of representation, and especially how God would represent him, and maybe even more especially how the doctors would represent him. Thought experiment. Try this. You are to be represented as, say the voices. Let's forget the as for a moment. Representation is always the threat of substitution. But is not that. Nor is it as far gone as doubling. Nor as weak as if. It's more like giving an impression, an overlay of difference. For instance, at the Dresden station, I saw a fair number of people who gave the impression of being railway passengers. Now, a question along these lines of some import, given the malign forces afoot, might be, if I am to be represented, to whom does such representing belong? Schreber's cosmos was infused by Persian elements, much as Nietzsche's was at about the same time. We're talking about 1895. And so I'm going to read a little Persian crossing poem. If you do this properly, you will be able to cross the boundary of death at will, the Holy One seeing into the mind of the King. Do you mean reading or telling? Asked the King. I noticed for the first time that we were seated in the shade of a tamarind tree. That attendants brought tray after tray of heavenly food, beginning with fruit, sliced papaya and pitted mango, guavas and bananas, sweet oranges and sugarcane. And I looked down into the coffin. You were not buried in, because you were burned in the fire and scattered into water with my own hand. But your body was rotting there, disintegrating like rags, and I was addicted to several painkillers. On the boundary, behind a cluster of tall reeds, I noticed several young courtesans who were splashing in the water, painted with red and golden oils that streaked down their faces. Seed heads of the tall grasses like fireworks, exploding without moving. Not thinking of the refugees in possession of nothing but their own unhappiness. Well, we're fucked here then, between the worlds of splendor. Stay out of the crystal pavilion, she'd said then. It holds a pool that leads to the world of humans. And if you fall in there, you shall not be able to return. Thank you.
That's Brian Henderson. Wow, what a fan. The second half is as exciting as the first half, and I can promise you that because I've read all of these ones too. The first writer comes to us from Regina, and he's a poet and a nonfiction writer and a fiction writer who just keeps surprising and opening up new ways of seeing all sorts of things. His new collection is called Bix's Trumpet and Other Stories. Please welcome Dave Margoshes. Please welcome Dave Margoshes.
Thank you, Charlene. And I want to say thank you to everybody involved with Thin Air. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for being such nice hosts. I'm going to read from this book, Bix's Trumpet and Other Stories. It literally just came out last week. So this is the first time I'm ever reading from it. We were asked to read something that fit in with the theme of being on the edge. And made me think of Jack Kerouac, who's been in the news a lot recently because this is the 50th anniversary of On the Road. A new edition of On the Road was published, and several other books about it have been published, even a novel in which Kerouac is a character. So I thought I'd read a few pages from this story, in which Kerouac is not a character, but he is referred to a couple of times, and I think the story evokes him a bit. It takes place in 1965, which was a peculiar year in which there was a conjunction of three cultural forces. The Beat Generation was in its last days. The hippies were just about to begin, the hippies being the heirs of the Beat Generation. And in that moment between them, when there was a vacuum, in rushed Topless Dancing. So this story is called Spiders Across the Stars, and it begins with a couple of lines from On the Road. The only people for me are the mad ones, the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time, the ones who never yawn, or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars. So that was Kerouac. Spiders across the stars. When classes ended in late April, Ben and Gail loaded their things into the back of his 1955 Pontiac convertible and made the long drive to San Francisco, west via Winnipeg and Regina, south through Montana to Oregon, then through the moonscape of the bitterly dry Columbia Valley to the coast. It was 1965, a year after the free speech movement that had jolted Berkeley, but 2 years before the Summer of Love, when thousands of people like them would pour into the city to live on the streets, smoking grass, painting their faces, and driving themselves wild on the plaintive strains of the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane. Driving south, Ben and Gail sang along to the Beach Boys on the car's scratchy radio. They knew no one in California, and their plans were shapeless and elastic. It was just where they knew they wanted to be. On the South Oregon coast, they stopped at the sea lion caves in the early evening to soak in the sunset over scenery that mesmerized them, the spray from the waves breaking on the jagged rocks below, leaving a fine mist of salt on their faces. It was almost closing time, and the girl operating the elevator said this would be the last trip down. They watched the raucous lions and seals with the others in their group, tourists in loud shirts. And then, on impulse, Ben grabbed Gail's hand, and the two of them pressed themselves into the damp shadows. After the elevator's rise, they made love on the rocks, slick and salty from spray. It was several minutes before the elevator girl came back looking for them, and they were already straightening their clothes, flush-faced and exhilarated. "Everything starts now," Ben said. He was 21, just through with his third year at Toronto, and not at all sure that he wanted a fourth. He was from the Lakehead, a tall, angular boy with a sharp nose, unkempt hair of indeterminate color, and piercing black eyes that made people uncomfortable. They settled on you with such naked interest. "I'd say it already has," Gail said, smiling. She was 19, the youngest in a large brood, but had been cheated out of the kind of doting affection many babies of the family receive, her mother having been stricken with a never-diagnosed ailment that left her weak and unsteady on her feet when Gail was only 5. Her father was a conductor with the CN, who often was away from their home in the Sioux. As a result, she'd grown up feeling apart and unloved, like the planet farthest from a cold, distant sun in some science fiction galaxy. They held hands as they walked back to the car, and Ben whistled a sprightly tune for the next few miles, the dramatic coast unwinding to their right like a spool of film. They'd been sleeping together for less than a month, but they fit together so well it seemed to both of them that it had been going on for ages. They were still surprising each other, but there was a comfort between them neither had experienced before. As if each of them had deciphered part of the code that explained the other. Gail was most conscious of that comfort during the long stretches on the drive down when they were silent, moments in the mountain night when the stars pressed down on them like a lover's breath and the radio crackled with unearthly static. They found a place in an apartment block on Fell Street, just a few blocks south of the intersection of Haight and Ashbury, though that conjunction had no special meaning yet. The windows in the living room, which had been painted shut, overlooked the entrance to the freeway. And on hot evenings, After Ben had pried the windows open, the hissing of tires disturbed their sleep. They had no furniture, but the landlady allowed them to use an old rubber foam mattress that a previous tenant had left behind, and they lay it right on the floor. They sold the Pontiac, and with that small stake, there was enough money to last a few weeks. They bought a few pieces of furniture and kitchen stuff at a second-hand store. Gail got a job waiting tables at Foster's Restaurant on Divisadero Street, where the tips were decent enough. After a few shifts, she was able to treat herself to a doctor's visit and a long-overdue birth control pill prescription. Ben, meanwhile, was looking around, answering a few ads in the miscellaneous help wanted column in the Chronicle every morning, but wound up spending most of his time while she was on shift hanging out at the City Lights bookstore, Ferlinghetti's place. He had no clear idea of what he believed or wanted for himself. He'd always been good at writing and had been working on the varsity and covering University of Toronto games for the Canadian press, which opened up possibilities for him. But he was starting to think that he was more attracted to poetry than journalism, though he had yet to actually write a poem. Sometimes, after an hour or two at the bookstore, he'd prowl North Beach, where the topless craze was barely a year old and going strong. Carol Doda was the big name on the strip, holding court at the Condor Club, but there were lots of others and an endless stream of joints up and down Broadway, each with a fast-talking man at the door coaxing passers-by in, carnival barkers in gaudy sports shirts with cigarettes dangling from their lips. "What about you, sport? Want to see something you ain't seen down on the farm?" "Not me," Ben protested, laughing nervously. "Sure, maybe you'd rather get your jollies thinking about it and playing pocket pool. Come on, they ain't gonna bite you. Come on in." He hadn't succumbed, hadn't been in one of the bars, but he did have a fascination with the color and popcorn and tobacco smell of the strip that kept him walking it, watching the tourists. Now he shrugged and backed away, suddenly shy. He took refuge at the Café del Sporte on the corner of Columbus and Broadway, which, despite its name, was dark and sedate as a church, filled with old men sipping espresso and playing checkers. He was sitting at a table by the window one afternoon, reading a paperback copy of On the Road, when a man about his own age, with an unruly beard and a twisted mouth, approached him. "You stole that, didn't you?" Ben looked him over, glanced at the door, then back to the young man, whose face was stony. "So, what's it to you?" The young man's face hardened another notch beneath the sandy beard, making Ben think of a slide he'd seen in his geography class last term of glaciers grinding over mountain granite. He leaned over, his face hovering close enough for Ben to see that the twisted mouth was the result of a scar, perhaps from an automobile accident, and abruptly sat down in a vacant chair across from him. The stone face cracked abruptly into a grin. "I was just admiring your style." He flipped his denim jacket open so Ben could see a book in his waistband. He took it out and laid it on the table between them, a paperback Under Milkwood, Dylan Thomas's Eyes and Cigarettes smoldering from the cover. "Blaze," the young man said, extending his hand. He pressed his palm against Ben's and quickly withdrew it, so that the two hands merely slid together rather than be gripped and shaken. "Where are you from, cowpoke?" "Canada," Ben said with a self-conscious laugh. "Toronto the good." Blaze hesitated just a moment. "Oh, yeah. Morley Callahan, right?" "That summer in Paris. Leonard Cohen, that it?" His eyes glanced at the book in front of Ben. "What brings you down here? Aiming to join up with the beatniks?" Ben smiled, embarrassed, but engaged by his companion's directness. Well, maybe not join. Take a look, though. Huh. Cautious man. He tipped a hand-rolled cigarette from a battered old Lucky's pack he took from the pocket of his red check cowboy shirt, put it in his mouth, and lit it with a match from a packet so worn and folded the printing on its cover was unreadable. You're just a trifle late. Year or two, I'd say. Ginsburg's doing Europe. Jack's drunk back east. Corso's in the desert looking for truth, and God only knows where all the rest of them are. Shit. He squinted up through his smoke to see if Ben was registering all this. I'm about all that's left. You'll have to do with me. I'm going to stop here. Thanks very much for listening.
Okay, so that's literally on the edge. That was Dave Margoshes. Thank you so much. One of the great delights of my job is encountering writers that I've never, ever heard of before. And when the manuscript for the Housekeeping Journals came across my desk, I opened it with curiosity because the title kind of piqued my interest. And I was just drawn into this very compelling, sometimes funny, sometimes painful life of a very interesting character. And I'm very delighted that Jim Nason is able to join us tonight from Toronto. Please welcome Jim Nason.
Hi, everyone. It's an absolute honor and pleasure to be here. I was walking around quite a bit today, and you really have a remarkable city. It's quite beautiful. So, a few quick things I'm going to tell you about Tony, the narrator. He's a big guy, much bigger than me. He's like 6'5", and that's important. He's a homemaker, and Tony's a social work student who thinks he has something to teach his clients, the people that he's been trusted to care for, and he's going to find out otherwise. They have something to teach him. Russell is tall, taller than Tony. His silk nightgown is gold with slits up the... Is that okay? Okay, let's start again. Russell is tall, taller than Tony. His silk nightgown is gold with slits up the sides, and when he crosses his legs, Tony can see he has very muscular calves. How can someone so sick, thin, wasted, still have legs like that? They defy logic, a contradiction of body physics, of masculine and feminine. They are every muscle queen's envy, every soccer player's dream. Russell wears lime green mules. When he slides into them, he towers over Tony. Donna Summers plays full volume, a duet with Barbara Streisand. Enough is enough is enough. Russell puts a small brown vial to his nose, inhales deeply. Do you want to dance, hon? He asks, extending the poppers to Tony, who can't help but notice the veins in his muscular arms and long, strong fingers, the thickly painted red nails. You must be Russell, Tony asks, avoiding the vial and the question. Jane Russell, he says. Are you the new maid? As he says this, he's spinning to the music, arms out to his sides like an airplane. Tony was warned that Russell was on the verge of being evicted from his apartment. Ignoring his question, he asks, what are your neighbors like? Oh, them, says Russell, waving his arms at the wall that divides him from apartment 207. They don't dare mess with a bitch on wheels like me. Turns up the stereo another notch. Tony goes into the kitchen, starts clearing a space on the counter to organize the dirty dishes in the sink. Get back in here, Russell screams. What did you say your name was? Tony, he shouts, walks past Russell, turns down the stereo, sits on the brown corduroy sofa. Russell sits next to him, as close as he can get. Exaggerated schoolgirl postures, knees together, shoulders back, head high. Russell's hands are folded over the open pages of what appears to be a photo album. We were the brave ones, he says. Everyone thought we were just stupid, fucked up, neurotic drag queens, but we weren't. Then he goes silent, most of us. He laughs, turns a page in the album, points to an 8x10 black and white photo that was made to look like a professional Hollywood portfolio shot. It is really of five men in bad drag by an amateur photographer, a group pose of a non-event. Russell is easy to spot, the tall one in the center. He hasn't changed much. His beard is still too heavy to be completely hidden by makeup, his body too square and too tall to even be the tallest of women. We were the stilettos, he says, the first classy drag act to ever hit the West. None of us were Roy Rogers, he laughs. We were more like Dale Evans looking for a ride on a man hung like Trigger. Russell looks Tony over as if he's feeling out the reaction. Those uptight Calgarians didn't know what hit them. He says they would terrorize the straight bars. Six or seven of us would walk right into the Marlborough Hotel in full drag. They'd all stop talking, but none of them would ever touch us. They were too afraid of Amy Anazon would do her tit thing. She was half done the change and had real boobs and was dying to sit on a real man's lap and show him her real tits while trying to grab his real thingamajig. Then we'd all get drunk and dance, the straight guys too. After 8 or 10 beers, some of them would ask us to dance as a joke or a dare, and we'd leave them spinning and confused under the strobe light and head down to the Parkside Continental. Except sometimes Annie Amazon and her real boobs would get lucky. Russell's caked-on makeup seemed to crack a little here, Annie. He began to say, but he then abruptly corrected his posture again, changed the subject. We were all queens at the Parkside, he said, except maybe Miss Diana Ross, who was really this pathetic white kid who sang Reach Out and Touch like a bored, anorexic housewife after too much sun, too many rusty nails, and an Adam's apple big and gaudy as $3 for $1 grapefruit. I'm giving you edge. Okay, so August is twin. Tony's moved along a bit. He's not a homemaker anymore. He's a social work student, and he has his first field placement in a group home for recovering addicts. So fasten your seatbelts. Oh, by the way, Tony's asthmatic. If any of you have asthma and have one of those puffers, you'll know what I'm talking about here. It was dark, only 8 o'clock, but black. August. A major thunderstorm was building over the city. Michelle, one of the clients in the group home where Tony had his field placement, had two tricks in her room. He could smell the sweet burned smell of crack curling out from under the door. Day staff said one of the guys had a gun and made no bones about flashing it before he went into Michelle's room. It's her fucking room, he said. She has rights. They all know the rights. The Tenant Protection Act, the Privacy Act, Form 14, Form 437, Form... Crack sex. It's common knowledge that once you've made it while on crack, plain old pot sex or beer sex isn't good enough ever again, and you'll bend or break every rule ever made to get back to that first over the volcano, across the moon, thrash, boil, and swoon. Tony wondered from time to time what that would be like. Be careful, he told himself. There's a thin line between going somewhere fun and going somewhere so much fun you ain't coming back. Crack, sexy as it sounded, is the far side of the edge. They have to be black, Michelle told him once in a session. It's the skin, the stone smooth skin, not the dick like everyone says. Tony had been in recovery house for 3 months. He couldn't have known to cut right past her sidetracking story, steer her towards something less overtly manipulative. He let her go. She went on to describe smoking crack in detail. Everything changes. The light, your breathing. At first, the pipe is just a pipe. Then it's a hard, loaded pipe. Then it's a hot, hard, loaded pipe. Then it's in your mouth, and you can't get enough of the pipe or the rock. She stopped. After a moment of silence, she went on. You like this story, don't you? She said. You like dark meat, too. Tony shifted in his chair, flipped over his notepad, tried to breathe, felt his face turn red. Michelle looked up at his calendar, a brave out-of-the-closet move on his part, the firefighter's fundraising calendar. Mr. August is twins. Two shirtless black men with big boots and trousers, more muscle than Atlas, more holes than any greedy soul dare dream of. That's racist, that Tony told her, trying to sound like a pro. Besides, he said, taking the calendar off the wall, flipping pages, look, the other 11 guys are white as milk. Milk. He should have stayed with his good old cooking with milk calendar. Tony dumped that calendar in the garbage when another client blurted out one day, oh my God, that's so gay. You're so busted, said Michelle. That's a little inappropriate, said Tony, said back. Inappropriate, my ass, she said back. He doubted her then, what she said about the smooth skin being the favorite part. Tony saw those guys, two guys, when the cops broke into her room, Mr. August and Mr. August, naked. You're fucking jealous, she said as they dragged her screaming from the room. In 3 seconds flat, those two guys were face down, tall, handsome, handcuffed, and naked. Tony tried not to look, but did, twice. Brightly dyed batiks on the walls and windows, a large wooden Buddha, piles of clothes and shoes. This would be one hell of a messy room for a homemaker to deal with. Condoms still in bright red packages, matches and lube piled on a mattress in the middle of the floor, Michelle's hamster, Crystal, spinning and spinning in the cage in the corner, and Tony's gray inhaler right above the face-down captives. From time to time, a flash of light filled the room, then thunder shook the walls, rocked the floor. It's your safety I was thinking of, Tony said, struggling to breathe as they slapped the cuffs on her, dragged her past him at the door. That's what they do, you know, a quick slap, a circle of metal, hard, cold on the wrists. Asshole, she said, more sad than angry, looking her age for once, 22, not 45. Guns back in holsters, cops with prisoners left the room. Tony inhaled bubblegum, sex, and sulfur. Kneeling next to the mattress on the floor, he saw what looked like a cube of sugar, only a little smaller and more like crystal, a rock. He held tightly the inhaler-turned-crack pipe that was, after all, his. Tony sprawled across the bed, imagined the naked part of just what just went down. The sheets were red and still warm. Busted! Michelle said, racing back into the room, making an imaginary gun with her fingers, cuffed together as if in prayer. Tony jumped up, held out the inhaler in her direction. You're so fucking screwed, she said as she spun on her heels to leave, bumped into the cop who just made it up the stairs, breathless, to the door. He was struck by how graceful she could spin, handcuffs and all. Tony closed and locked the door, tried to breathe, but couldn't calm down. That's when he automatically reached for the inhaler. Everything hot got hotter. The red and orange batik curtain of fighting roosters fluttered over her window, shot up to the ceiling twice, then settled down. The storm was over. The windows filtered light from the moon, and the room looked clean and organized. He was peaceful, but couldn't calm down. Thank you very much, everyone.
That's Jim Nason. A great book, Jim. The final writer tonight hardly needs an introduction. I think she's probably been a favorite of many of us for some number of years. And I had the great pleasure of actually having a conversation with her this afternoon at the afternoon book chats. It's always news when Shauna Singh Baldwin has a new book, as she does right now, called We Are Not in Pakistan. Please welcome Shauna Singh Baldwin.
Thank you for having me, and hello. I'm shorter than most people around here, I think. But anyway, thanks for having me over here. It's delightful to be in Winnipeg. It's my first time here, and I can't see any of you. So, but I want to thank the many efficient and dedicated organizers of Thin Air. I think you've put on a wonderful show, and thank you very much. And also for bringing us here together tonight. It's a really special group. This is my fifth book, and for those of you who have read some of my work before, it's going to come as a little bit of a shock, because when you read the 10 stories collected in We Are Not in Pakistan, you'll be in many different parts of the world and in several points of view, most of which are human. I broke two major rules in writing this book, the write what you know rule and the write about your own community rule. But these characters bothered me, asking me to write my way into their lives, and I just had to find out how they came through situations ranging from a nuclear accident to a hate crime. In Rendezvous, Jimmy McEwen is sitting in a Greek restaurant. There he meets his old friend Enrico, and then the waitress Tula, and finally Carlos, a busboy and illegal immigrant. I'm reading from the section where Tula enters, so you'll need to imagine me as a Greek waitress. I've abridged it, but I do hope it'll give you a flavor of the story. Hey there, Jimmy. Sure, I'll sit down. I'm on my break. I got a whole 15 minutes. I was avoiding your eye, Jimmy, because of Enrico talking to you. He a friend of yours? Okay, I'll tell you something I won't tell many others. I don't like him. Leaves me his dirty poems as tips, makes me mad with his guy jokes, makes a big mess and calls me over like I'm going to clean up instead of Carlos. But you're not like him. I told my ma about that time when you took me for a ride on your Harley last summer and we went over the Hone Bridge clocking 90. I said, that man's got some pep in him yet. He's not just some boring two-bit attorney. Yeah, well, Ma said, don't get no ideas, Tula. That guy's married. I said, I ain't getting any ideas. We're friends, aren't we? Besides, you're way too old for me. Safe as condoms. Ha ha. And you don't laugh when I say I've got dreams. That Enrico, he don't think anyone's got dreams except himself. Keeps telling me I should cut my hair this way or that. Says he'd like to cut it for me. Offered to come to my home. Said he was a personal hairdresser. He just wants to get in my pants. He's got balls. I'll give him that. A few years ago, all kinds of guys wanted to get in my pants, but a woman gets burned a few times. Well, she gets ovaries. Which reminds me, did you try the Eggs Benedict today? No? I made the sauce, and it came out real smooth. It's not much, I know, but it's something. How are my dreams? Fantastic, Jimmy, and none of them are about you. But I'll tell you, they ain't always going to be dreams. No way. I'm going to be a sculptor. How about that? Tula walking in the footsteps of Myron and Polycletus. And you know why I'm going to be like them, Jimmy? It's because I can see people from the inside and outside at the same time. That's thinking like a sculptor, isn't it? I borrowed this book out of the library, real thick with glossy pictures, all about famous statues. Do you know what they thought was beauty in classical sculpture? They said it's when each part depends on the other to create harmony. And that's how they came up with the idea of democracy. No shit. I read it. Didn't they teach you that in law school? You want democracy? You gotta go back to greasy old Greece before Galactoboricos and Spanakopita. Maybe even before the Olympics. But the Greeks got it wrong, too. They ignored the slaves and the women. Everyone who had to run things and clean up after them. It wasn't beautiful, because it was out of balance, see? But what can you expect from a bunch of old men? Anyway, I wasn't interested in all those Caesars and Italian guys. I wanted to look at the women's statues, you know, like Liberty. Wanted to know where she came from. You heard of a place called Colmar in France? You ever been there in your travels? Well, one of these days I'm going there, because that's where she was made. That's where Bertoldi had his workshop. Yep. He made her in France and shipped her all the way here. And you know what else? She's got two things, one in each hand. I bet you know one, but tell me the other. Gotcha. You can't think what it is, right? Okay, I'll tell you. It's called a tablet. Not the pill kind of tablet. A tablet. Just like a slate or a plaque. Liberty's holding it like a book. And you know what's written on it? Think. Try to see it. No, it's not the Ten Commandments. I'll tell you. It says July 4th, 1776. In all those funny Roman numerals. Now, what do you suppose the sculptor meant by that? Do you suppose he meant anything by that? Or do you think it's there because that arm had to be there and he had to do something with it? What do you think? I guess they didn't teach you symbolism in law school. Well, now that I read this book, I know all about symbolism. That tablet is about living under the rule of law. Awesome! That some Frenchie could think of that. And nobody these days knows that? Not that crowd in Washington, Bush and Cheney and that slime ball Karl Rove? They don't think laws apply to them. Only to people like me. It's depressing some days. Yeah? A big attorney like you? What do you have to be depressed about? So you're not as good looking as you used to be. But you ain't worried about where your next meal is coming from. Don't give me no sob story about how your wife don't understand you. Arlene, right? I seem to remember your Arlene has more sense in her pinky than a lot of men. I got a friend who's got business sense just like that. She makes wedding cakes, says I should come help her. Says sculptors were just making cake molds using plaster and metal in place of cake batter. And they probably learned it from watching their wives make cake. Did they have cakes when Myron was around, Jimmy? Maybe you can look it up on the internet and tell me. Well, what's it for if it doesn't have that kind of information? You can use it to find me? Well, I'll be damned. Who'd want to find me? Oh, when I get to be a famous sculptor. Well, I don't have no bank account, so I wouldn't use it to check my money. I don't have no stocks or bonds, so I wouldn't need it for that. Air tickets? What's the use of me checking air ticket prices? You gotta have money to fly, buddy. Ah, I could check it to get a different job. I could check the paper for that. Oh, in a different city. Yeah. But I have to be close to my grands. I stop in and check on her every day before and after work, do her laundry. If I got a job far away, who'd do that for her? She only speaks Greek, you see, so my mom and I are the ones who talk for her. Of course, if I go to school, I'll need a second job so I can pay the tuition. Maybe I'll go decorate cakes after all. It wouldn't be much, but it would be something. I could find a student loan on the net, huh? That how you got to be a lawyer? With student loans? How many years did you spend paying them off? Oh, you had the GI Bill. We don't get nothing like that these days, and I'm shit scared of debt, buddy. That's what you learn when you're the daughter of Greek immigrants. Pythagoras didn't have no debt, didn't he? Euclid didn't have no debt. That's because they had slaves. Didn't have to work themselves. Didn't have to pay no minimum wage. That's how they got to be philosophers. The internet can tell you that. Ever heard of a guy called Sassafras? No, not Sassafras. Sisyphus. My dad is always talking about him. Says Sisyphus got himself in trouble with his boss, and his boss put him to rolling a humongous boulder up a steep hill. And then just as he rolled that thing nearly to the top, it would roll back down. And he'd run after it all the way down to the bottom and have to start all over again. I would have quit. Maybe he couldn't. Oh, yes. I can relate to Sisyphus. Sometimes I don't want to get out of bed in the morning because I'm real tired and my feet ache. And then I think, hey, someone's waiting for his coffee at table 7. And the guy who always sits at 9 likes his eggs over easy and not runny. And who'll look after them if I don't? And that gets me moving real quick. So I wonder if Sisyphus felt like that every morning. I wonder who he got up for. Hey, Jimmy, did Sisyphus get minimum wage? What about health care? My dad said they don't have things like that in Greece. That's why he left. So they couldn't have had it in Sisyphus's day, but they'd have to give him time off to sleep, eat, and crap, right? My dad's been wrong about a lot of things. So when you get a chance, you ask the net for me. But maybe the answer will be in Greek, and I can't read it. You couldn't either? Well, you could have fooled me, but not my gran. Oh, yeah, I could do a second shift right here. Yeah, old man Petropoulos, he's my dad. He'd put me to work like a shot if I let him, in the kitchen serving coffee, bussing tables like Carlos. But I say, no way, I'm Greek, not Mexican. I got my pride. Carlos says I'm stuck up like my dad. That's what he says. He says it's money. That's all that matters. But how would it look if I was in college and some student stopped in here and saw me bussing tables? I'd have to be in acting school for that to be cool. So what'd you think, Jimmy? What are my chances, slim or none? Think Tula could be a sculptor? I like molding things, giving them a lift so they look alive, like my customers after coffee. It's not much, but it's something. Ask the net. It's all there, isn't it? Okay, maybe it's not the Delphic Oracle. Dad told me they kept those priestesses behind the scenes like waitresses. They always gave advice from Apollo, but didn't anyone ever wonder what advice a priestess would have given if she was asked what she thought? Or what she would have said if she wasn't always doped up and stoned? Anyway, she was always giving them riddles. So they'd have to come back and ask some more questions. Isn't the net like that? I guess if I ever go back to school, I'll ask it everything. Hey, Jimmy, did you try the new coffee? I switched our brand to hazelnut cream. Dad hasn't noticed yet. Tastes better, huh? No thanks, Carlos. I don't need no coffee. Like the new menu, Jimmy? I worked on it. Figured I could make a bit of the world more beautiful. See that green and maroon border? I did that. Not much, I know, but it's something. Gotta go. Need a smoke and a pee before I put my hairnet on again. Tomato feta salad, rosamarina soup, and a roll. I'll put in your order in a minute. And the Greek custard afterwards, sure. Say hello to your wife for me, and next time you come, ride that Harley. I'll take a break, and we can rock it over the Hone Bridge again. Thank you.
That's Shauna Singh Baldwin. And that brings our first evening to a close. I'm so glad you could join us tonight, and I hope you will come back again this week. Tomorrow night, Eleanor Wachtel will be here with her new book, Random Illuminations, Conversations with Carol Shields. I'm looking forward to that conversation. The night after that is going to be a wild night of adolescence. Adolescence, by definition, being kind of a wild state. Thursday night is Writing from the Rock with a bunch of great Newfoundland writers. Friday night, Saturday night, Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, daytime starting, you know, today. The Nooner happens every day at noon. Afternoon book chats happen every afternoon. There's stuff on the campuses. Get that beautiful little book or visit our website, which is winnipegwords.com. And while you're there, if you're interested, you can check out the blogs. There's a hot air blog on there. Definitely worth the effort. Thanks so much for coming tonight. Come on forward and talk to the writers. Good night.